welcome. First of all, I'd like to thank our sponsor of today's event, Variety, and also Chrysler. And supposedly there's test drives happening down behind the Metro floor, so please stop by, and they're giving merchandise away, etc. So big sponsor this year, Chrysler. I'm so stoked. I mean, this group of panelists are pretty amazing. One of my favorite movies this year are represented here, almost all of them. And I'd like to introduce the first panelist, Gil Kanan, director of the Academy Award-nominated Monster House. Yeah. Director of Academy Award nominated Cars. Todd Field, Academy Award nominee, Best Screenplay for Little Children. Field director. Academy Award nominee, Alejandro González Iñárritu. Academy Award nominated Little Miss Children directors Valerie Faris and Jonathan. I'm sorry, Little Miss Sunshine. Sorry. Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton. I'm very proud to introduce an old friend of the festival who's been with us, you know, for years supporting us. The great editor-in-chief of Variety, Peter Park.
Good morning, everybody. And thank you, Roger. Dear Roger is so hip, the way he runs this festival, that he even imported Sundance weather. We were talking backstage about some of the folks here who were at Sundance. The big crisis at Sundance this year was how to keep all these companies from coming into town and giving away millions of dollars in swag. That was their big crisis. And I was thinking to myself, you know, the answer to that problem is bring them to Santa Barbara where no one gives away nothing. Anyway, guys, welcome all. I know many of you have been going to a succession of events evolved in the season, and little our friends from Little Miss Children. I can predict, even though I have no business doing so, going to win the SAG Ensemble Award at the SAG Awards tomorrow night. They better, because we've already written the story. What has this, Jonathan, what is this ritual done to your personal lives? You're going out virtually week in and week out to one award event after another. Have you guys managed to work? Valerie, Jonathan?
It's definitely, you know, we spent 5 years trying to get our film made, and we really, for us, the finish line was actually Sundance, just our first screening, and we had no idea that it would take a year. I mean, a year of our lives has been spent just promoting it. But the cool thing about this particular time of year with all the, you know, award shows and things is you actually get to meet other filmmakers, and it's the only time you actually get to talk And it's fun because you kind of do bump into the same group at each event. It's very nice. So
I think I'm the only one on the panel that would complain about having to wear something different to each event.
Yeah, I just changed ties. She's, you know.
But the Golden Globes is different in that the sense that, as you all notice, Alejandro, I think I saw you there. You turn a corner and you run into either Tom Cruise or you find yourself peeing next to Rupert Murdoch.
You know, I actually peed next to Rupert Murdoch. And I was like, oh my God.
both of us did. In fact, that both of us did gives me worry.
I think he goes there a lot. Sorry, no, this is Santa Barbara, right? We're okay.
Alejandro, your picture, brilliant movie, is indeed something of a dark horse. Did you see yourself undergoing this fusillade of award shows a year ago?
If I foresee this?
Yes.
No, never. That's totally true. Always we thought that it would be, you know, a film that would be hard to accomplish, to have some audience in a way that it was a risky thing, in a way that it would be always like a foreign film, and obviously it would be even tougher because it would be a different culture. So I never thought that the film would have that impact. And now that it's happening, now I think that's what I can say. It's a beautiful journey in a way that you are able to listen to what people think and feel about your film. The good things, the bad things, and it's a good thing to learn. It's a learning process. You have to be very humble to hear the worst things in your life. But at the same time, you hear very beautiful compliments that make you feel at least that you've done something that's worth it. But I never imagined that I would be doing all this all around the world.
Well, the wonderful aspect to it, the subtext, is that just think of all the box office rewards the picture will get as a result of the next 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, that in itself is adventure. Todd, the issue of what one takes away from every movie. I remember talking to one of my favorite all-time directors, Clint Eastwood. He was saying that every movie he makes, he finds, ends up being a learning experience that changes his attitudes, but he can never predict in advance what that item is that he will learn. I was curious what your reflections were on that, in terms of little children, of course, in the bedroom.
Oh, boy.
I asked you the shitty question, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Peter. Sort of what Alejandro was saying is, you know, when I was at the American Film Institute, I remember I had a really good teacher there named Stuart Rosenberg. He used to always tell us that, you know, make your film and make your choices and then get out of the way, because the truth is that you can't go around and explain your film. And you're probably never going to hear really what people think about your film other than the critics. I'm really glad I believed him, but it's not true, because you do, you know, when you have a film and it sort of becomes part of this conversation as part of the year, you come to events like this, or you come to other things, and you learn about your film, you know, as Alejandro was saying, you learn for good or for bad or for indifferent in terms of people's reactions, and you can never predict what those are, and I think, you know, you have a very different perspective when you finish a film and when a film is shown than you do when you're making it. Because when you're making it, it's a very abstract process. It's a very practical process. It has to be abstract. If you were completely emotionally invested constantly, it would be exhausting, and you'd never get through it alive. But in terms of learning anything else, I've just learned that, I'm terrified every time I start work on a film, and it's a really excruciating process. There's no joy in it for me at all. So, there are moments of discovery, but for the most part, it's just a really terrifying thing.
John Lasseter, of course, we know is not just a director, he is this great guru of the animation business, a godlike figure, the man Walt Disney would like to have been had he been able to come back.
Thanks. Thanks, Pete. Is that a question?
The experience of directing, and that's a stupid question, an animated picture, when you hear about the adventures of live action directors, tell us, relate the experience of directing animation to directing live action.
there's one fundamental difference. In many ways, it's very, very much the same in the sense that we really work on the story, and it's about entertaining your audience and getting the best performances from your actors, which in our case, they're both the actors who do the voices as well as the animators, and getting the look of it to support the emotional core of the story. The fundamental difference is that in animation, the actual process of creating the animation is so expensive because it's making something hand by hand by hand. It is, what you do is we can't afford to do coverage. We can't afford to do multiple takes. So therefore, we have devised the thing, and Walt Disney kind of created this long ago, but we've really perfected it now with nonlinear editing systems, is that we create a version of the movie before we start production. We use storyboards and story reels. And we will work and rework and rework and rework these story reels. And again, it's just like what your Todd's teacher at the American Film AFI said, is that there's no excuses, right? With pitching a storyboard, you know, the performance comes from the story artist as he has a pointer. It's a classic way that Walt Disney and all his story artists used to do. And then kind of make it seem more entertaining or more moving than it kind of really is. But a story reel, lights dim, it starts, we have temporary voices, temporary sound effects, and temporary music, along with these still storyboard drawings, and you sit and you watch it. No excuses. It is what it is. If it's going to make, if the story reel makes you laugh and moves you, then the final film will do times 10. But all the expensive animation that we can put on will never save a bad story. It's my number one rule. And we will work, and Joe Ramp, my partner, a great story artist, he always says, it's not storyboarding, it's story rework. Because many of our sequences in Cars and our other films have we reworked nearly 30 times before we put it in production. And we will spend, on average at a Pixar, we spend about 4 years on a movie. And 2.5 years of that is nearly solid story work. All of the Pixar films, Cars is our 7th movie at Pixar, the upcoming Ratatouille is our 8th movie. All of the films we've made are original. They're not based on any books or anything. They're ideas we've come up with. And it is, and it's challenging because we have to start, you know, in you're developing not only the story, you're creating the characters from scratch and the world that they live in. Because our worlds are not realistic, they're believable, what I call them. You want to get sweep the audiences away. That every single thing you see in a Pixar movie has to be designed, modeled, shaded, placed, lit, everything. We get nothing for free. There's no location in our films. And so the challenge of that is really to sort of, you want the audience not to think about those things. So often I'm working with our artists, and they've done something exquisite, groundbreaking, technically amazing, artistically beautiful. And I'll go to them and I'll say, sadly, the audience won't notice this, but they'll notice it if it wasn't there. It's that good. And so I think that but we, at Pixar, we are filmmakers in the same way that these brilliant, talented people, you know, directors are. And we talk in the same terms about emotions and the story structure and all those things. So in many ways, it's the same, but we just kind of flip the process on its head a little bit.
And the one difference is indeed true to you guys as filmmakers, that you make so much more money than anyone else.
And we get die-cast toys and action figures made from our characters, too. Come on, Little Miss Sunshine, action figures. Great to have that van and the... Even though you put batteries in it, you still have to push it. A little just children figures. A whole new thing.
Now, Gil, I have to ask Gil Kenyon the one question I know every young filmmaker would like to ask him, and maybe Kurt already has, and that is, how is it possible to come out of junior high school get one deal with Spielberg for your first picture, then you're working for Tom Hanks as your second picture. I mean, who do you know, and how can you...
Well, you just mentioned my uncle and my grandfather. I'm actually kind of still trying to figure it out, you know, like 3.5 years after the fact, but really I just caught a lucky streak. I mean, I made a film at UCLA, my thesis film, that somehow got me in a room with Bob Zemeckis, and somehow I was able to convince him to let me direct this this crazy huge movie. And so for me, it was really just kind of being in the right place at the right time. You know, my film wouldn't have been seen by anybody unless it had screened at this one night at the BGA. And somehow I was kind of pulled out of that, and I had one chance to convince this film hero of mine that I could, you know, not screw up this big movie. And so I was lucky. So,
I see you crossing the street against the light. I'm going to follow you. Now, you're starting your second picture,
right?
Is it also motion capture?
No, it's not. The next one is a live action film, but it has a kind of a lot of the sensibility that I bring with me from animation. In much the same way that that John was saying, the world in this next film is going to be completely created. The entire film will take place in a soundstage. It's a science fiction film, and so, you know, there's a lot of things you learn. There's a power you get when you work in animation, where you learn that you have absolute control over the environment, and that's kind of intoxicating. I think it's going to be difficult to wean myself off of that. It'll take a couple of movies.
Well, I'd like to ask all of you about the casting process. Even casting voices, John, must be a complex. How do you cast a voice for a Pixar show? I mean, you can't do audition. Do you audition Robin Williams? Or?
In an animated film, first thing we do is look for really, really talented actors. Who we will start with creating the story and the character, so we have an idea of what we want, you know, the voice to be like. We never hire anybody to put on voices. At Pixar, I always look for things being natural. I want to, as the audience watching our movies, it just kind of, sort of, it's real, it's natural. Even though it's toys, or bugs, or monsters, or cars talking, you just want to feel like it's natural. It's just happening. And so we look for the actor, number one, that they're a really good actor. Number two, that they have a voice or a personality that we've seen in many movies that lends itself to the character. And then, and what we do, this is very interesting, is that we'll take a scene from a movie or a TV show that of an actor we're interested in, and we'll take just their voice, and we'll put it up against, we cut a little piece of, you know, on the Avid, or Final Cut, we'll put some drawings of the characters that we have, or even an early model or something, a computer model of the character, and we'll put the voices up against it to see how it sounds. And it's a very, very interesting thing, is that there's many actors who are brilliant actors, really great, but when you take their physical acting away and just listen to their voice, two things happen. Either it will fall flat, it'll not be as lively or punchy, or the opposite happens, it just jumps off the screen. And that's something to us that we are always looking for. And it's a very interesting technique because it really works. You really look at it. And then we do what we call Pixar non sequitur theater. We take and we cut, because most of the times, you know, our movies are about relationships. And we want the voices to kind of work. And a lot of actors' voices are in the same tonal register, right? They kind of, well, who said that? Is it this guy or that guy? And you don't want that to happen. You want to have a clear distinction between the voices. And so we'll cut, you know, dialogue back and forth, and it's, you know, from two different movies. And so we don't really care that what they're saying doesn't make any sense. It's just we want to hear the voices. But sometimes it's the most hilarious scenes you've ever seen. It's just the most non sequitur stuff. And the last thing we look at is I'd love to get actors who can ad lib, make something their own. oftentimes you get, you know, if they just read kind of the script the way it is, the writer or us in the story department or something like that will write something. It's maybe not quite the way Tom Hanks would say something, or Owen Wilson or Paul Newman. And I encourage them to sort of take what's written or the meaning of it, kind of reword it the way that they say it, because I want it to sound just perfectly natural. When you're in a art form that takes 4 years to make something, spontaneity is not something that just goes hand in hand with animation, except in the recording studio. And it's very important to me to get spontaneity. And so we've since gotten really excited about working with actors that can ad-lib. You know, Owen Wilson is fantastic. Tom Hanks is amazing. Is the voice of Woody the Cowboy in the Toy Story movies. We would, anytime Woody touches something, I make sure there was a prop that doesn't make any sound, and I hand it to him. And that guy just comes up with ideas. In Toy Story, there's a scene where Buzz's arm gets broken, kind of his severed arm, and he has to do a puppet show with his severed arm to sort of pretend to the Andy's toys that Buzz is still alive, right? So I my son's had this kind of fake arm that you slam in car doors and stuff like that. And I took it from Tom, and I handed it to him, and I swear, I still have that kind of videotape of the run he did about 5-10 minutes of just the most hilarious stuff with this fake arm. And it was fantastic. But that's what we love. Bonnie Hunt is one we use in three movies. She's has a lead role in Cars. And she's one of the greatest ad-lib comedians of our time. It's great. And I think the final thing we do is we actually I look, and if we really like someone, and I look and I see if they have kids, I know we have. Because I know they love our movies, and I know that they, for their kids, they'd be a hero if they were in one of our movies. And I look and I go, nope, single.
Alejandro, I mean, you have the perfect cast involved. Did you know that was the cast that was going to work when you started this picture? Did you imagine that you'd get these folks?
Well, it was in the case of Babel, it was a very, very extreme situation compared to 21 Grams from Amores Perros. In this case, I knew that I was going to face the reality of what was available in these countries, which I didn't know well. So in the case, I thought about Gael always, and Brad, and Kate, and Adriana, Adriana Barraza, which plays Amelia, who has worked with me in Amores Perros as a small role as the mother of Gael. But rather than beyond these four actors, I have to find all the other characters around the world. And I think what John is saying is very interesting for me. I think the voice is very important for me. You can have sometimes great faces, but the voice is horrible. And it's completely attached to what the character should feel, should hear. And I try to close my eyes and imagine, but when it doesn't work. And something that I always I'm looking for is for I'm calling the interior life of a character of a person. I always feel that if somebody has some I would say interior or spiritual life in a way that I can feel that there's some gravity in him, there's some range. I would call these like when I'm talking with the actors or I'm getting just close to them to know them and to pitch them the role. And I can feel that they have this emotional baggage inside them, in the reality that they can be attached to. Not particularly that emotion that the character will run through the film, but something that they can be close to that kind of emotion. If something has happened in their life that they can go inside themselves and pick something, and then that, you know, convert that in something that I know that it will work, that's enough for me. And I can see that in their eyes. That there's some gravity that you can feel in the eyes of or a superficial actor or somebody who has gravity. In this case, in Babel, I went to Morocco and I tried to look at the film industry actors that were there. And unfortunately, all these actors were from a very, they were mostly, working in TV and soap operas, so they were having a lot of habits from the TV, and it wasn't working for me. And the schemes were very, very, you know, for the urban cities, Casablanca and cities like that. And I was shooting in the south of the Sahara, so I need these faces that really can show me the sun and the desert in their faces. So 17 days before, I end up deciding that I will look for people in the street. So we went, all the team, we went to the town. And in the south of the Sahara, we start in these small towns without light, without plumbing, without nothing. People that has never seen a camera. Basically, we start to call them from the mosque and from the you know, from the mosque, and the imams, you know, in minarets. They began to call all these people, and they began to form a line. So they were not praying; they were just waiting for us. And we videotaped them. And then little by little, I began to find the boys they were playing in football, or the guy who ended up taking care of Brad Pitt. It was a guy that arrived to the office as a computer system assistant. And I said, well, you know, I have better plans for you, my friend. You want to have a, you know, Brad Pitt film with you? And he couldn't believe, but it was true. So, or the veterinarian, for example, that stitch up Kate, it was the real veterinarian of that town. So his hands literally smelled to a goat that day, and Kate was like really dying. Or the old mother, it was the old mother that lived just beside them. So all these people in Morocco, beside Kate and Brad, all of them were just people that I have to find in 17 days. And again, just look at them, and because I didn't speak the language, basically I was just basically doing exercises with them with numbers. So I said, okay, do you have to threaten these guys? Look at the opportunity, yeah. Threaten. Okay, so it was with numbers. So 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And so it, with 1, 2, 3 exercise, I just can feel that if they were like really mad, or they can have that moment.
Alejandro started as a disc jockey in Mexico City, and he has generously offered to give me voice lessons.
No, and you know, let me just add one thing. The most scary thing for me was to cast in Japan. In Japan, I was very, very stubborn to cast a deaf Japanese girl because I thought it was politically correct to have a real deaf Japanese. So when I went there 1 year before to start casting, I had myself with my bad English trying to convert my Spanish to my English. Then I'm in English speaking to a Japanese translator, and then the Japanese translator to a deaf sign language Japanese. At the same time, there was a small girl completely afraid in front of me, which was deaf, and the translator in sign language said something. So I said, have some time imagine some sound or something? Can she ever imagine something? So I said that in English, then this other girl, the girl just stand up like that, she thinks 1 minute, then she returns sign language to Japanese. When the Japanese answered me, it was like, yes, in June. I said, in June? And all the Japanese that are surrounded in Gokikuchi were deaf people. So imagine the shooting of that, it was like, almost like I feel like the Three Stooges between my ears.
Jonathan, I found myself talking with Alan Arkin the other day, and I said, what convinced you to do Sunshine? And he said, well, I admit I'm sort of a sour and negative person. And I met them and I said, they haven't directed a movie before. And I don't want to work for a husband and wife. They're going to get into an argument over what take to use. And it's clearly a movie I don't want to do. And he did it, and said it's one of the greatest experiences of his life. How did you manage, over the period of a few years, to pull together such a remarkable cast for your movie?
I don't think it's anywhere as interesting as Eleanor or John's, but I mean, it did take 4 years to get this movie greenlit, and over that time period, we met with a lot of actors, and we sort of had a lot of different people in mind, and actually I think these were such great characters that it was easy to imagine a lot of people, and you know, they were really well written characters. But I guess when it came time to actually make the movie, we had the money, we could make offers to people, which you know, then, and the cast came together very quickly. And I think the thing we were most concerned about was finding actors who could, kind of what John was saying about, you know, we just wanted a kind of naturalness and a realness to the whole, to the family and the way that they played their characters. And I think finding people who, you know, they're not so far vibing in the role that they're not having to reach too far for, in the role, I think was part of it. And then, you know, finding a family that some, where the chemistry felt right.
You know, we wanted a certain realism, a certain truthfulness. We knew the film could be funny, but if it didn't feel truthful, we felt it would be kind of a hollow laugh. And so the challenge is to find actors who can give a real truthful moment and yet still understand comedy enough to just, you know, be there for the humor. So, and then you have to make sure they're all kind of in the same movie. So we had a week of rehearsals where we could really improvise and develop those relationships, because we knew that the biggest challenge was to create a family that seemed to have a history. You know, so many times you show up on a set and you have to be someone's husband and you've never met them before, you know. And so by having a week to just build these relationships, which, particularly between Alan and Abby, the grandfather and the granddaughter, they kind of worked off on the side, just really doing what a grandfather might do with his granddaughter, so that when it came time to shoot, we knew they were great actors, so we didn't have to, and we were comfortable with the script, so it wasn't a matter of testing out lines, it was just building those relationships.
And did you guys ever go Bill Hawkins' nightmare and have an argument about a scene?
We worked all that out in the 4 years that it took to get there. I know it's boring, but we didn't really argue.
Tell us, though, your first choices for those roles. Bill Murray, who were you going after first?
Well, it's kind of a little bit complicated by the fact that we were at a studio for 3 years. And, you know, their way of making a movie like this is to cast people who, you know, they can sort of put on the poster. And it's just a different way of building a cast. So I think we did go down those roads early on because we were trying to get, you know, to make it in the studio way. So we did offer it to Bill Murray and we never heard back.
But you know, those things, it's always tricky because, you know, you offer it to an actor like that, but you also say, and we're going to pay you a tiny, tiny sum. And to ask,
yeah, and you don't even have a start date, so you're just kind of floating it out there. So you know, it just, we spent 3 years doing that,
and also without you know, in an ensemble, we're offering it to these people, and we're saying also you're going to share the dinner table with five other people. So it was really a matter of making the best thing that ever could have happened did happen. That we made it independently. Got all our first choices. When we had our money, went to everyone that we thought was perfect for the role, and then, you know, it worked out. You know, we were very fortunate.
You see, Gil, it ain't that easy. So, Todd, you and I talked about Kate Winslet in your picture, and here was obviously a wonderful English actress playing an American role, not a role that both she and you, I gather, agreed up front, was not a sympathetic character. That the audience is not asked to like this person. Did that attitude evolve over time, or was that sort of the given when she first, when you guys first talked about it?
Well, that was a given. I mean, that was, she was this, you know, it is a large group of characters in the film. But if there is a central character, it was always going to be Sarah Pierce. And fundamentally, you know, based on Tom's novel, that character is not particularly, you know, I guess, for lack of a better term, likable. You know, she's, like many of these characters, is trying to figure out you know, some things about herself. When we first meet her, that was something that Kate understood, you know, from the beginning. And, you know, I've told this story before, but I think it's worth retelling. You know, the first week that we were shooting together, you know, we were doing takes, and then takes that involved her and this little girl, this 3.5-year-old little girl, Lucy Goldstein, or Sadie Goldstein, who plays her daughter Lucy. And Kate just kept pushing it further and further and further in terms of how abrasive she would be with the child. We had a rule from the very beginning, which was never to touch her. Don't ever touch her until the very end. You never caress her, you never kiss her, nothing. And she would push it and push it and push it. And I remember actually, I can tell this story because Jonathan and Valerie and I share a set of producers on our respective films. Albert Berger was one of my producing partner on The Salon of Ron Yerkes. So Albert was on set, and he came over to the side and said, you know, she's really, you know, she's not very nice. It's really not good what she's doing with that child. And I said, no, it's great, it's great. And then the studio called after a couple of days, very upset, and said, we don't like her. And I said, yeah, isn't it great? I told this to Kate, you know, I hesitated at first, and I thought, no, I'll mention it to her, I should mention it to her, which I did, and she just, you know, she just burst out laughing, and she said, oh, it's wonderful, isn't it? So, it was something she understood from the beginning. I mean, that character is, if it's building to anything, it's this moment with the daughter, and that moment has to do with finally being able to see that child for the first time.
Kate is a great character. I once asked her that, after all, the immortal scene in movies this generation is the Titanic scene where she and Leo are holding each other passionately. And so I asked her, what non-verbal scene, amazing scene, what did you say to each other just before that scene started? And she looked at me gravely and she said, I said to Leo, how the hell could you order an onion sandwich just before we're married? So now, Todd, you are a writer, and you are a writer first of all, and wrote the script. How much interaction, I've always meant to ask you, John, is how much interaction is there between you and the writers on a picture like Cars or the other amazing movies you made?
In the Pixar, this is what we call it, it's a director-driven studio. What I mean by that is that the ideas generally come from the director. So the director is involved from the beginning in the creation of the idea. We will inevitably always, certain directors like Brad Bird and Andrew Stanton are brilliant screenwriters unto themselves. But in the case of the films that I direct, I'll bring in a script writer and work with it, but they become kind of part of sort of the team in a way. We have this small story team. We have what we call a war room, which is a room dedicated to just the story on one of our movies. And we go in there and just discuss scenes and discuss the whole thing. And it's about, you know, they're kind of a part of the team. They'll go off and write pages for a scene as some one of the artists is drawing it up, or we do it in different ways. Oftentimes we'll start with script pages and then give it to a story artist and he'll draw it and they'll work together on it. Or the script writer will come in after a scene has been already storyboarded and kind of rework some of the dialogue and so on. Yeah, but they become part, all the screenwriters that we've worked with at Pixar become part of the story team. It's not like they go off somewhere else to write a script and bring it to us. They really become part of the team. We are very, very lucky to have Michael Arndt. You know, we've worked with us on a couple of projects, and he's such a great person in the room to sort of talk about it. And it's one of the kind of key things that people ask what the success of Pixar is. And I think it's we have this collective group of directors and story artists that we've been working together by and large since Toy Story. And we're very honest with each other, you know, about when things are working, when things are not working. And even if, no matter whose movie it is, whose director's movie it is, that we will show early versions of the story reels to this group. I call it the brain trust. We bring people together, we'll look at it, and we get together and have a notes session. And it's not about who's the most powerful. We don't have any of the sort of studio executive kind of stuff going on at Pixar. It's all about everyone's there to help make your film the best it can be, and you know that. You know that. And they're very honest with you when it's working, when it's not working. And what's nice about being actually in the Bay Area, away from Hollywood, is it's about making the movie great. You know, that's 100% focused at Pixar. And so we incorporate the writers kind of in this brain trust as well. And when you experience it, it's like such pure honesty about filmmaking, about making movies great, making movies for our audience. You know, it's not about ego, it's not about position, it's not about, you know, it doesn't matter whose idea it is, the best idea that's going to make the movie better is always used. And I'm the creative head of the studio, and I lead by example, because to me I'm the biggest collaborator of the bunch, you know. The thought of going off to a cabin somewhere by myself to write something is like David said, Eric said, I would be looking at seeing how my hair would look parted in the middle. You know? That's so true. When you said that, I thought that's exactly what I mean. It's all animation's most collaborative art form, and that includes the screenwriting too.
Gil, how do you work in that regard?
Well, you know, I had kind of an interesting experience on Monster House, because it's actually kind of like making two movies the way I work. And the first part was very much like a traditional live action film development. I worked on the script with the writers, and I did incorporate a story reel, like John was mentioning earlier, just to get a sense of how the film would play out. But when it came time to shoot the film, to work with the actors, we actually, the film was created using performance capture or motion capture animation, so that the actors were physically there in a space, looking at each other, performing with one another. And so that was kind of a forerunner to the animation. And then kind of the actors all went home, and I took off my directing hat and put on my animation hat. And for the next 2 years, worked to actually take those, you know, those souls that were captured in the space and fit them and make sure that they were transferred safely into the animated side of the film. And so it's, you know, it's like making a few different movies in one.
So let me ask each of you this question, since we are just approaching Oscar season. As directors, the Oscar show, A, do you watch it? And B, if you were reinventing it, what would you do?
Well, you know, it's funny because our film is really about rejecting the notion of beauty contests. And so, we're a little conflicted. But, I've watched the Oscars since I was a kid. It's just one of those things. I mean, it's one of the last television events that so many people, the whole country, tends to all gather around. So, and it's important. And I appreciate that it's other filmmakers and actors, you know, people in the film business who vote for it. So I think it's probably one of the more pure, at least should be, and but definitely living in LA now and seeing the campaigns that happen, it's a tough thing. So I wish
don't knock them.
Yeah, well, no, they've helped us at times, believe me. But I love what SAG does, which is the Ensemble Award, because I think that actors working together can really be a beautiful thing that should be acknowledged. So I would add that to the Academy Awards.
So Valerie, do you want to add?
I don't know. I feel like we should have the same kind of awards for teachers, that's all.
Alejandro, you're going to be a star of that. what's your feeling?
What the Oscars have? I would invite more Mexicans, maybe. I guess I was really, you know, I think for me, I'm sure that for them to be competing is very uncomfortable. You know, for example, the New York Film Festival is very beautiful because, or Telluride is just a show of great films, and you end up just having fun with the filmmakers, and there's no this uncomfortability about the award that somebody put you in a star and say, you are the best, or, and it's something like a little childish, I think, because every film is so different than trying to achieve, so for me, so uncomfortable that. It's very uncomfortable. I would change it. How? I don't know. But I think it would be beautiful that it would just be a show there, and just to honor the films that maybe are the best according to the Academy members, and just make a presentation of them and talk about them in a way. But the award thing, I don't know. I'm utopic here, but I think that will never happen because that would put the tension and the ratings, but it's a little bit awkward to be competing with great filmmakers. That's the only thing that I do.
Todd Field.
American culture is, we're driven by the ideas of black or white, you know, the best. I want the best car. I want the best wife. You know, unless you're getting a little, old and fat, I think I'll stay there. And as Alejandro said, you make a film and you have an impulse to tell a story and you do the best that you possibly can, and hope, I think a modest hope is that it's not embarrassing. art is a real, eye-rolling, dirty word for a lot of people, but I believe that this is an art form, and and it's meant to entertain, and it's meant to engage people and strangers and people sitting in the dark together, and that's why we tell stories to each other. We don't tell stories so that we can win American Idol or any of those other things. They're very good for ratings and very good for a lot of fringe industries that feed the movie business, sort of like going to war. It's like Halliburton gets real rich, But I would be lying to say that, like everyone else here, I didn't grow up watching the Oscars, and I would be lying to say that, like everyone else, people that aren't in the movie business, as a child, I sat there and rehearsed my speech. So I understand why we're all interested in it, and it is exciting, and I won't say that it's not, but it's not why we make films. And I don't know how I would change it. I think the idea of the New York Film Festival, I tell you, right, we're not giving out prizes and they're simply showing films and trying to have a conversation about those films is a very good one, but that's never going to happen. That's not what the Oscars are about.
John, last year you got your category this year. What did that mean to you?
I tell you, to have a Best Animated Feature Film category at the Oscars, now we have one at the Golden Globes, and a number of the Directors Guild and the BAFTA in London has a category, and I'm extremely proud of that. A lot of people said, well, don't you feel like it's now a ghetto? I said, but no. It's like we finally have a chance to celebrate the animated film as a whole. In the past, there's only been one animated feature film ever been nominated for Best Picture, and that was Beauty and the Beast. And in the entire history of animation, and the best an animated film could hope for at Oscar time is a song or a score or something like that. And when Toy Story was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, it was the first animated film in history to be nominated for that. And that was totally caught us by surprise. It was thrilling, And, by the way, that year I went to the Academy Awards in an Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. And I've done that a few... Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me. I've done it now 4 times, and this year will be my 5th. And as Elton John said after I won the special Oscar for Toy Story, went to his party, he looked at it, and looked at the car, and goes, oh, I get it. An Oscar winner in an Oscar wiener. Yeah.
That was you?
Yeah, I threw you the wieners. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's the only Oscar he ever got. So Oscar Mayer, what's so cool about it is they come, and typically the limos are black and the drivers are in the black suits. It's like these are college kids in these Oscar Mayer jumpsuits, and they're like, oh, like, and they're so excited to be there. And I get in there, and I'm like a big kid, as you can tell. And, wear the white shirts for my movies, but. And they give me a box. I mean, a box. Oscar Mayer wiener whistles, right? To throw, and I'm out the sunroof. And now you have to understand, for those who haven't been to the Oscars, there's this like channel all of Los Angeles, kind of with limos and stuff, about 10 or 12 blocks away from there. You gotta go through this and all the security now, and going back and forth and trying to get there and stuff. And there's protesters all along the way. It's like, ah! I'm a movie fan. I love movies. And I grew up watching the Oscars like we all did. Folks, the thing that is the most amazing is that red carpet. It is the single thing in this world that's the most insane place on the planet. You have the stands full of people, fans screaming. You have the press. And for those of you who've never been on a red carpet, looking at the photographers, screaming your name, just trying to get you to look that way. And of course, I'm a director of an indie film. I'm a nobody, right? And I walk down, and the couple said, hey, John Lasseter, no? Okay. So what we do, it's a big game for us. When we stand back, we always find some actress, right? And we'll stand behind her. The photographers are always waiting for them to get their gowns perfect, right? And so we wait until they do the strike the pose, right? Just then we go, oh, look, hi. So then it's our game. We look at people and us and stuff. Ooh, look, they're right behind so-and-so. We have fun with everything we do. So it's great. But one of the things that I've been nominated before, I have the fantastic, I love, I love the art form. And I'm a member of the Academy, and I'm on the Board of Governors, and I love the Academy for what it does for furthering the art form and the science of motion pictures through the years. But one of the things that people, what's very special about the nominees is the nominees luncheon. It's the one time that it's not a competition. Everyone there is winners, and they leave out, it's just the nominees at a guest, and the Board of Governors, and a few key press, but it's not about interviews. And you get to go up to everybody, and talk to Martin Scorsese. Hi. I do animation. It's great, And so it's really wonderful. And the other thing for me that I actually love about the Oscars is that they, for 73 years, they've been giving out Oscars to short films. Live action and animated short films and documentaries. And I tell you, I've been on the board, and we every now and then there's something, well, we need it, the Oscars are too long, let's take those out of the Oscars. And what's great is all the filmmakers in the Academy rise up and say, no. No. This is a chance for everybody. It's like, you can make a film these days with the simplest, everybody has a film studio, at their disposal with high definition, inexpensive high definition cameras, Final Cut Pro on your laptop, And you sit there, you can make a movie, you can, you know, get it transferred to 35 millimeter, release in the theater in Los Angeles, and it's eligible, you know? And I tell you, if it's good enough, it could win an Oscar. You could be standing on there winning Oscar, and the short film Oscars are just as tall as Best Picture. And I think that's one of the great things about it. And what was exciting is that one of the governors, John Bloom, of our branch, the short films branch, has been working for a very long time. We now have a distributor that once the nominees are announced, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but once the nominees are announced, the distributor, it's like the deals are set up right away, and the short film animation and documentary short films are released in theaters around the country between the nominees and the awards. So people actually have a chance to go to a movie theater, watch the short film nominees in those three categories on a big screen, and it's fantastic, and the response is huge. And iTunes has started downloading them on there, and people are like excited that they have a chance to see these films. You know, and because the short films is such a fantastic art form. I've been making short films, and we make short films at Pixar, you know, and we keep making them. And I said, for every Pixar feature film, there'll be a Pixar short film in front of it. And thank God Toy Story was a success, because now they don't question that, you know. And so we're starting to make it, and Disney, too, we're starting to make short films.
I'm gonna nominate you to be the next director of the next Oscar show. I know... It'll be a great show, and it'll be 9 hours long. Mayor Gill, have you written your acceptance speech yet?
I have to say, like, I'm still just freaking out that I get to sit at this table, let alone like go to the Oscars. The whole thing is just silly. And if I can use it to prove to my mom for once and for all that I actually directed Monster House. then it'll all be worthwhile. For me, what everyone's been saying here is so true that the last couple of weeks, like from the build-up to this and the Golden Globes, has for me been most important because I've actually been able to meet other filmmakers. And it's something that, you know, as a kid who grew up loving movies more than anything else and who desperately wanted to get into the business of making film, to actually meet my peers and my heroes has been kind of a miraculous event. And just every time I meet someone, I feel so honored that I get to actually make movies and, you know, stand alongside them. So for me, the Oscars is going to be kind of the cap to this insane, surreal dream. And I'm not writing anything. I'm just going to be happy.
Maybe that is, I forgot about this thing that happened, which may be one of the boring moments of the Oscars. Normally, when I watch it on TV, is the musical moments, you know. And last year or two years ago, it was happened something that really got my attention was Motorcycle Diaries was nominated for Best Song, and Jorge Drexler was a fantastic Uruguayan songwriter. And he composed a song, he sings the song, it's a very folky, simple guitar song that he sings beautifully. And suddenly, the Oscars, you know, will play the best nominated songs during the show. And suddenly, the producer said, well, the only song that will not be sung by the artist will be this one. I said, why? I mean, I was involved because Walter Salles is a very good friend of mine, and Gustavo Santaolalla was the score guy, and Gael Garcia was involved there. So we had a conversation, we felt, you know, very insulted about it. I said, why? Well, because the guy doesn't get ratings. I said, well, Jesus, but the guy composed the song, he's the artist, he's the guy. I mean, okay, somebody has to know him better, and then he will have ratings. How if you got ratings? You don't expose him. Anyway, at the end, it was Antonio Banderas and Carlos Santana in this adobe wall. Antonio Banderas singing in a flamenco style. Carlos Santana with a loud guitar without no sense. All this spirit of the Che Guevara was completely out. It was embarrassing for all the Latin American communities around the world. And it was like, this is so... Well, finally, I have a happy ending. The happy ending was that at the end of the show, our poor guy, 2 hours later, you know, we have this huge conversation. Walter, Gael even quit to be in the show that day, that night, because he didn't want to give an award in that situation. At the end, Jorge Rendez was singing just in the theater. He won the best song that year. He stepped up, Prince gave him the Oscar, and you know what he did? Instead of giving a speech, he just sung. Sing 30 seconds of Capella song, thank you, and that's it. You know?
The one thing that consistently baffled me was what we're talking about, and that is that when given their moment in the sun, that all people usually can think of doing is to thank their lawyer, their agent, their proctologist, their next wife. So why can't folks do better than pull out that terrible list? And of course, I guess the answer is they're actors, and actors need writers. We'd love to hear questions from you all if you have, and by the way, thank you all for your wonderful remarks. The question was, can you relate what your actual first job in show business was?
I was... One summer during film school, I was someone's personal assistant cleaning up their dry cleaning. Directors.
We were hired to do a sort of a documentary-based music show for MTV. That was my first job, directing it.
My first job was car wash. And that inspired me to not be there, so that's why I changed. And I ended up doing the score and AD of a short film when I was 18 years old.
I was a projectionist at a second-hand movie house.
I was a ride operator on the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland. I'm not kidding, and actually I was very shy before that, and it brought me out of my shell, and I got so excited. It honed my sense of comedy, because these jokes are the worst jokes. And I just got into the craft of how to make these things fun, you know, it was fun.
My actual first job ever was as a hypnosis assistant, but that was a disaster. And then my actual first Hollywood job or a showbiz job was when I was 17. I was an intern at Disney in cutting rooms. So I basically kind of learned how to code and cut my hands on you know, film, and I had a lot of real kind of life-changing horror stories where there was a screening that was coming up, and I remember I was working on this one film called Dangerous Minds. It was like a Michelle Pfeiffer film, and there was this big screen for Bruckheimer, Simpson Bruckheimer, and I was carrying this giant platter of film, and I was about to put it in the film canister, and I was an idiot, and the core fell right out of the middle, and there weren't any assistants there to teach me how to wind it correctly, so I just pulled it out. First I collected my breath, and then I just started turning the core back, and you know, like 2,000 feet of film later, it was life changing. So.
This is directed to Jonathan and Valerie, two producers, guys who actually brought you into Little Miss Sunshine, Ron Yerxa and Albert Berger. And also the guys who first ran with a script to try and get it made were disqualified from receiving the Oscar if and when Little Miss Sunshine wins. Do you have anything to respond to that? Anything to say to the Academy? Any reactions?
Well, that's a good question, Jeffrey. And, you know, who really cares whether two, three, or four producers go up there and ask and claim an Oscar?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, I mean, we're really so disappointed by that decision, but and it's hard because we appreciate the Academy's desire to limit credit to those people. people who really had an essential role in making a film. I think that's smart, and we support that. However, Ron and Albert were absolutely essential at every stage of making Wellness Sunshine. And they are among the five producers. They are on the film. They will always be on the film, and they will always be producers of the movie.
And, you know, luckily, the PGA recognized all five of the producers. So, you know, we wish that they could have made an exception to the rule in this case, but...
I hope they'll find some resolution to that, because I think it's going to continue. When a film takes 5 years to make and it's done on a shoestring budget, you have a lot of people in there helping to make it happen. So it's a difficult situation. And it was a very hard thing to see happen yesterday.
Yes.
I'd like to see comedy as a separate category in the Oscars, because I don't see how Catherine Deneuve and, you know, share can be the same category. But anyway, as directors, you watch some really emotionally taxing things, and you have to bring that out of your actors. And I know a lot of actors sleep with those characters. Do you find it difficult to sleep, or do you find yourself laughing in the middle of the night, or do you carry the emotional weight after the day?
But the question is, do directors carry the emotional weight of the various traumas that their actors are going through in the film? Who wants to deal with that?
Well, I would like to say that for me, when you shoot the scene in the morning, an emotional scene, like a kid is dying or some very tough scene, in the morning it's very hard to shake that scene, at least for me, at night. You know, you still have that, you know, you... It's only you are leaving the film in a way, and it's good that you are. So shake it out is not easy, but at the same time, as Todd said, you cannot get too much attached as a doctor getting surgery every day, because if you get attached emotionally to the client, you will kill things, but you will be crying while you are having brain surgery, and then you will split the glove. So it's a combination of be aware of, you know, how much you have to be, at least for me, and then I try normally that when we are shooting that kind of scenes, try to break the ice with some joke or something, because that relief, because if you get too serious and you take that serious, that then it becomes like, you know, raining in the wet water, and then it comes like a bad scene.
Right.
So it's a combination, but definitely I have been sometimes feeling depressed and I don't know why, and then I realize, I will not be depressed if I'm just leaving this environment every day in the hospital during this scene or whatever, you know what I mean? So there's something that you have to leave, but at the same time, be smart about it.
Thank you.
I just pulled
me
up.
Anybody else? Okay, well then, thanks.
Sure.
Darkest moment you face, and the highest moment you face. What an epiphany. What moment
please show us your pain.
Favorite ice cream flavor. Well, I guess I'll start. Right now I'm like I said, I'm in pre-production on a film. The experience that I had on this film was completely foreign from anything that I had before. Obviously, it's my first film, and just to kind of compound that, the film that I had done just before, my thesis film at school, I made by myself in my kitchen for $400, and so there's a little bit of a discrepancy in the process between the two films, and so the greatest lesson was learning how to make a film with 200 other people and learning to trust these other artists and knowing that the quality of the film is dependent on their work. So for me, that was the biggest lesson, and that's the most the thing I had to work the most at, and found the most rewarding ultimately. And in terms of epiphany, I mean, you know, this film really for me was about creating a personality to an environment, making a house an actual emotional character. And for me, in order for that to even begin to work, I had to have an idea that this house could actually have a soul, have a spirit. And I knew that was going to work the day I saw Kathleen Turner in her dots and wetsuit kind of get down on the stage, and we built a styrofoam version of the entire neighborhood in the sound stage. And when I saw her kind of completely give away to that character and start to rampage around the character around the neighborhood, and really fully for the first time I saw that this thing was going to work. I saw that there was going to be a semblance of life in that house, and so that was my epiphany.
John Payne.
The film we're working on now at Pixar is called Ratatouille. It comes out in June, and Brad Bird's directing it, who did The Incredibles. It's about a rat that wants to be a cat. He's awesome. About a rat that wants to be a fine chef in Paris, France. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the most extreme fish out of water story you've ever seen, but it's beautiful. But the more importantly is all Pixar films, there's a core, you know, idea, and it's about following one's own passion against all odds. And it's a fantastic story. It's really funny too. So that's what we're working on. But the for me with Cars, you know, there's a certain every Pixar film at one point or another is the worst motion picture ever made because of the story reels you look at and what were we thinking, you know, and you work on it. And there's always a time when you, and that's very painful because it's a long process. Everybody gives you notes and helps you try to make the film the best that it could be, but then they leave the room, and then you're sitting there with your little team, your story team, and you're like, ah, okay, let's go through it. Joe Ramp, my great partner, always said, trust the process. You know, we believe in this movie, let's just keep going. And there's always a time when we have a screening of a story reel, you know, that has some animation or whatever for our group, and it works. You feel it. You know, and even this jaded audience has seen it a million times. They're laughing, they're being moved, they're like, and they come out and they go, yes, you know you have it. And then it's like, so you've climbed that hill, you push that boulder up to the hill, and then it's like, then you have the production of the film ahead of you, but the story's behind you, you know what you're making, and you can direct all the people around you to all the little pieces, because every tiny little thing in our films is there to support the story. And so the hardest part of the production for us is always when you know the story's not there yet, and yet you have all these people on the project, and you have to kind of feed the beast, I call it, where you have to get footage into the, you know, lay out the first stage of production. You have to kind of, to meet the quotas, to get the movie done on time. You have to do that, but you know the story's not right, and it's always a struggle. But once you feel like you have that one screen, that we've landed it, then it's... it's much easier.
But I think the one thing that would get under your skin is that because of your success, there's so much animated product out there, and much of it is
only about shitty.
Well, you know, I actually look at it the other way. I love animation. I love animation of all mediums, and I'm so excited that there are so many studios producing animation and that people are willing to invest in it in all the mediums. And I actually am very, very excited about it. And like all live action films, and I, look, you know, not all of them are best pictures, you know. There's a lot of good movies and a lot of bad movies. It's the same with animated films, but films are being made. Artists are staying in our medium. I would much rather be a player in a healthy industry than be the only guy in a dead industry. And to me, that's the thing that I think, as long as people, you know, the movies that make the most money in the box office are the ones that truly entertain audiences, and they talk about it to other people, and families go, and people want to see it again. You know, and that's because the stories are good, pure and simple. Technology will never entertain an audience. It's what you do with the technology. And so it's the more that the filmmakers are given the reins and less of the studio executives, and they're able to really kind of make entertaining films, you know, the more they'll make money, and hopefully it's, it'll start a cycle of making this, a lot of great animated films come out every year. But I'm a big fan of the whole
thing. Pass along your words of encouragement to Jeffrey Katzenberg. I'm still reeling from the fact that John is the wiener guy. No, I really am. I've told the story so many times that you just made my whole year. I have to add to that story, though. After the 2002 award ceremony, we were all standing waiting for the limos, and there was apparently John riding the wiener coming down the road. And I was standing next to Judy Dench, who doesn't know anything about the Oscar Mayer wiener, and she said, "Oh my God, there's a man riding a banger coming down the road." I would imagine you get the same answer from a lot of us, which is what you all are saying, right? If you learn anything after making films, is that at some point you're going to live or die by trusting you're going to figure something out through process, that it's always about process. It's not about, I would be dubious of anyone saying, this is what I knew I was going to do and then I did it. You know, that process is something you must trust. And in terms of, you know, what you find while you're working on something is, and what's surprising is what Gil was saying, is you've got 200 people, and it might be your key grip, it may be your actor, it may be the person you're working on the script with, it may be the craft service person, and it may be a family member who gives you something that is so essential and almost unthinkable that it wasn't there before. That's what's really fantastic about making films. And that, because otherwise I think it'd be a fairly thankless process. It would be a couple of years of your life and, you know, you'd be connecting the dots on, you know, like a paint-by-numbers set. It would just be a completely trumped-up thing to do with your life. And it's those moments where you're excited. You know, Tom Perrotta, who wrote the novel Little Children and also wrote the screenplay with me, you know, we worked very hard on the script, and I think we both felt that we had a very strong script, but that script was improved in so many ways by everyone who became involved with the film. And I think probably the moment where I felt most excited and I thought, okay, I've got something here, was a moment that was never in the script and was, you know, something we were struggling with, which was, I don't know how many people in the room have even seen the film, because I've probably not even played here, but there's a moment between this character and his mother, that Ronnie and his mother, May, and it never really worked, and it was really driving me nuts, and I came home when we were in pre-production, and I said to my wife, Serena Rathbun, who's worked on all my films in some capacity, you know, I just said, this is making me nuts. And she said, well, you don't have the scene. You know, the scene's not there. And I said, well, I know, what is it? She said, this is what it is. She literally just gave it to me in a burst.
And as soon as she said it, I realized that it was the complete center. If there was a center to the film, it was in that speech that she just laid out for me. And then when Phyllis Somerville, who plays the character who delivers the speech, gives it to her son Jackie Earle Haley, I thought I'm going to be okay. This is what the film is about. But I never knew that going in, and I didn't know it until right before we started shooting. That's exciting, and it's probably, if there's anything of value that I learned along the way, it is. It's about process, and it's about everyone, the strangeness of how things come together in a film that you're working.
Well, folks, all of you have contributed great moments to our lives through your work. And we thank you for that and for being here this morning.